stop it there because there's three or four other ones, but I thought it would be more interesting for us to start grounding ourselves in what questions that you might have. And I'm going to actually reiterate something that came up with before we actually ask of you your questions. The thing that the first couple of videos talked about, which was this flow of scholarship. How is it flowing right now? And why is there a problem? And what is open access the kind of solution that's being offered? And is it something that is of interest to you all? So as you all know, you are budding scholars. I'm sure that you, if you're not yet publishing, you will be about to shortly, if not by the time you get to your dissertation or thesis, because that is, in essence, something that will be made public or published. So you publish a work, but right now, the way the system has evolved, you as the author have given your work to a publisher who now owns the rights to who can access that work, essentially. So it's even more complex than that, but that's the most important piece of it. You publish your work with a publisher, they make you give the copyrights to them. And the only thing, in essence, that you could still have rights to is the right of attribution, the right to say, this is my, I created this work. But copyright, when you surrender it, gives away the right to make copies, to distribute, to share in a classroom, to create derivative works. So right now the system is actually kind of clamping down on who can share that work and how. The owner of the rights of that work gets to control how it's shared. Now, typically publishers are created in order to publish, to disseminate the work. But the system has really become a very commercially profitable system. And so by making the access to it expensive, publishers make money and actually reduce the access to the scholarship. That's the way the system has essentially evolved over the last 20 or 30 years. But scholars actually want people to see their work. And as the world becomes a smaller place, we want people all over the world, even in disciplines tangential to our own, to find our work so that they can build on it and use it in subsequent work. So, what has evolved, scholars in the 1990s in particular started to say, hey, we've got this new technology that makes it extremely simple for me to share my work. But if I've given all the rights away to a publisher, and the publisher, only those that can afford the subscription, and you saw an example of those subscription costs that an institution like KU pays for, If a publisher restricts the access, your work is not being seen by everybody that it could be seen by. You also have the advantage right now because you are a member of an institution that has the $4 million it spends per year, $4 million a year, we spend on journal subscriptions, okay? So we spend that money, but isn't it kind of funny that, as one of the videos pointed out earlier, you as the author, or your professor, your advisor, gives that work out to a publisher who then sells it back to the university so the institution can actually, you can build on new work, okay? It had been, and sorry for a couple of you who might have already heard my little spiel on this in an earlier meeting this week, it really had been the way that scholarship had been disseminated 30, 50, 100, 200 years ago was really part of a gift economy, okay? So that I, as a scholar, I give my work essentially for free to a commons of scholars, a knowledge commons, and then I can draw on that commons later and take back things I need to continue my scholarship and to build on it. It's been really disruptive, and so scholars have now started to find ways to work around the system. One of the ways that scholars are working around this has evolved into what we're calling an open access movement, okay? Or open access. It means a variety of different things, and on one of the handouts you have, you'll see described in more detail what can open access actually mean. But essentially what it's doing is it's not changing the way your work is reviewed. It's still vetted by experts, but when it's published, a parallel system provides access to the work openly. So you can ask, you can decide as an individual scholar, I'm going to share my work. I'm going to retain enough copyrights to share my work on my website, on a digital archive, so that there can be a parallel system for access. So that those at institutions that cannot afford journals, or the specific journals that they need, could find it on Google, for example. So that's kind of an aspect of trying to give some context to both the videos and what where we're coming from with open access. I don't know if Tom and Mark want to add to that before we start some discussion and questions, because this might be pretty new to some of you.
I would just throw in that KU is a pretty unique place right now, because the Faculty Senate 6 months ago, after quite a bit of work by some of the people in front of you, the Faculty Senate approved a policy, which is, it gets complicated, but essentially what the policy says is that by virtue of being KU faculty members, we grant KU a permission, we don't give them copyright, we give them a license, it's like a permit. But we give them a permission to do things with our scholarship that is published in journal formats. And amongst those things, the most important one is providing open access. So let's say I submit a paper to a journal. The journal adds all sorts of value to it by typesetting it and peer reviewing it and things like that. But I may end up transferring copyright to that journal. But what the open access policy says is that I've already given a license to KU to take some version of that work and put it online. And that opens up a whole world of access. But KU was the first public university in the country to have such a policy. And our peers in this are Harvard, Stanford, MIT, us, and what, Trinity University, and was it
Duke recently?
Duke.
I think Emory's on its way.
All right. And then was it Drake or Drexel that just happened this week?
Oh, I don't know.
Anyhow, it's fewer than 10 universities. And it's probably more than 100 universities that are scrambling to get involved in this. I'll be going a week from now to give a lecture at University of Denver. And you just see all of this enthusiasm. So this is something that's happening. And it's happening because those journal subscription costs, which are rising massively, are choking us to death. $4 million. And that's going up. And so either KU puts in more money, or we cut out access to journals, which somebody in this room is going to want.
So I could add just maybe a couple of words to this. The $4 million isn't just KU paying that out, but obviously it's you paying that money as your tuition dollars into the funds that go for those rentals of information every year. That's not buying subscriptions, by the way, that you'll keep. That's buying rental to access the electronic versions of the journals that are being rented to the university. As the state contributes less and less, more of the burden falls to you as students to pay those costs that it takes to keep the university running, which means that this is one of the ways that we can push back and keep those tuition charges from continuing to go in the direction they're going, which is nothing but up. The other thing I wanted to add is also the prehistory of this. We're ahead of the curve not just because we've adopted a policy, but the penultimate provost, David Schulenberger, late 80s, early 90s at KU, foresaw this problem and did something about it and developed a digital repository for KU. So it's not just that we're putting things up for open access, which could be just putting things up on your website, but rather it's a very well thought out and integrated system for sorting and indexing and also preserving for posterity all of the archived electronic versions of the research that are being deposited there. So we could have the open access policy, but also implement it too, because we have this system in place. And as Town mentioned, other places are scrambling to do this, but part of the scrambling is just putting the infrastructure in to even think about doing it in reality.
So, that's a good place to start with a question, yes.
How would accessing an open access a document affect citing that document in our own work and future work?
Good question. And it would vary. For example, if you put an open access version of the paper in KU ScholarWorks, which is our digital archive repository, right? The metadata, so in a catalog record, in the library catalog, you know, there's information who's the author is, publisher, etc. Yeah, right. In the record for the item in the repository, it would have a link to the publisher's version, and it would have the full citation of the one that you would cite. So that would kind of, you wouldn't necessarily cite the ScholarWorks version, although you could give the URL to it. Does that answer your question?
You would be expected to cite the published version.
Okay. This seems like, though, the open access version could not be a copyrighted version, a version that has been copyrighted by a publisher.
Oh, good. Okay, that's an interesting question. So the version that gets put into KU ScholarWorks, how do I say this? If I'm the author, I write the paper, and she publishes it in her journal. If I want to share it in KU ScholarWorks, I will have to have retained enough copyrights when I negotiate with the publisher so that I have the rights to put a copy in the repository. So those rights that are still inherent on the copy that's put into the repository. Okay. So the analogy's been given in the past that when you're the owner of the copyright, you create an original work, okay? It doesn't matter what it is, actually. My scribbles have been copyrighted by me. I'm the owner of them until I give those rights away. Just like if I own a house, I have to transfer the ownership of those. I can transfer part of it if I want. I could say, I'm selling you the garage, but I'm keeping the house. Or I could say, I'm leasing the garage to you. And so essentially, when a copy goes into KU ScholarWorks, an agreement has to be known that, yes, you can share it and that you have the rights to share it out. And you're letting other people see it, too. Okay? Other questions? Yes?
One of the videos mentioned author fees. Does it become partially the responsibility of the author of the articles to then pay for publishing in open access?
That is one of the models that's being experimented with by some publishers, particularly in the sciences. So they create an entire journal. All the articles are available online, openly, no subscription. Any reader who finds them on the web can get to them. But how do they make money? You know, it costs money still to have this stuff. So one of the models that some journals are experimenting with is the author pays the subscription, a fee when their article is accepted. More common in the sciences. Very uncommon in the humanities and social sciences, that experiment or pilot. So those fees can be quite high and create some problems of their own.
But we should emphasize that what we're talking about under the open access policy here is within the current system of journals. So you go to the same journals, and they'll have their same policies. So whatever you've been doing or your advisor's been doing all along, in the sciences, yeah, sometimes we pay authorship fees, sometimes we don't. In the humanities, that's rare. But whatever the current system is will be the system. It's just that when you get to that stage of the journal has accepted your paper for publication, instead of transferring all of your rights blithely to the journal, you say, I'd like to hold on to this, and this right. The journal can reject that, and they do that sometimes.
They reject the negotiation.
Yeah, they reject the request that you make for those additional rights. And in that case, your paper is published and you don't have those rights. Okay? But if the journal allows you those additional rights that you ask for, then you have these additional possibilities. But the whole rest of the system, whatever you do in your field, stays the same. Okay? Separately, and I think this is what those videos were talking about, there are open access journals. Okay? That's a different way of skinning the same cat. And so Mark runs a journal, I run a journal, that are actually hosted and subsidized by KU libraries. Okay? So if you go to the great high-impact journal of biodiversity informatics, there are no publication fees, no page charges, no subscription fees. You just go, and there it is. And so what is that? It's KU libraries donating server time and a very competent person to make sure that it all works. And it's two professors here at KU and one at University of Colorado donating time as editors.
And so it's a workaround, basically. It's stepping out of the current model that had developed where, you know, somebody develops a commercial interest and your scholarship becomes commoditized, basically, so that someone's going to make a lot of money off of it. But it's not the scholar, it's not the university, it's not the public who's paying the taxes to fund the university, to fund the faculty member. It's actually just a private corporation often. I think some of the data we recently gathered was 60% or 70% of what they know of the 20 or 30,000 journals that are published in the world, 60-70% of those are commercially or privately held or published privately by private corporations. I know there were some other hands. I want to keep your questions, sir.
So when you're negotiating this, is there going to be some training provided to researchers? And is there going to be a fee that colleges are going to require if we're all going through this route?
Of
this open access? Because it sounds like it might be something that a lot of people are invested in the future.
Well, for example, yesterday, two times this week, we had this Copyright 101 publisher agreements, come and learn about how those work. So that it's a good portion of my job that I actually work with faculty, and I am happy to work with graduate students. Send me your publication agreement, and I will help you understand what it means. If you want to adjust it in order to know that you can share a copy openly. The more important thing is there isn't a policy for graduate students. And in fact, the policy that's at KU right now is there's no open access police coming after the faculty to make sure that they've done this. It's really kind of a coalition of the willing to say, how do I and how do we as an institution share out, make sure we can share out our work as publicly and widely as possible. The thing that we're hoping that you all start to think about is that as you are creating new works of scholarship and creative works as well, that you think about part of the role of a scholar now is to remember that you are stewards of the access to that work when you create it. If you give the rights away, entire rights away to somebody, you've lost the ability to control and to steward who can access that and how. So yes, the publication agreement is one of those key moments when publishing particularly journal articles. It's a different thing when you're writing a book and you're hoping to get a few dollars a month check on royalties for your, you know, a scholarly book. When you finish your dissertation, you might want to publish it as a book someday. The second part of your question, though, I wasn't exactly sure.
I guess I'm looking at this long term. Mm. I mean, if more universities buy into this and more researchers buy into this, then these private corporations aren't going to be able to provide the service. They're just going to kind of bypass that. Mm-hmm. So then a lot of this is going to fall onto the universities. And how's that? I mean, do we need to be more trained as researchers and public people who want to publish? Mm-hmm. And who's going to provide that? Is there going to be just a shift of fees, really? And that's kind of what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
This is an interesting situation in academia, mm-hmm. because usually we're asked to do more with less, or usually we're asked to do, you know, we're given all these unfunded mandates, And this is a mandate, or this is an idea where the money's actually there. Okay? That $4 million is replicated at every other university in the country and a whole bunch of universities around the world. So do the math and think about how much money is being spent on essentially subsidizing the commercial scholarly publishing industry. Now, there's a transition that's hard. Okay? How do you get from a closed access system to an open access system? But the money's there. And so I guess my view into the future is that the commercial industry is not going to just hold on to this goose that lays golden eggs for them right now until it no longer lays golden eggs. They're smart people. We've actually been provided with industry analyses of the open access movement where they're tracking our success. And they're basically saying, at what point does our business model start to become less profitable? And I think that what they will do, and you already see them providing open access options for a lot of journals, where you put in $500 more and your article is open access. They're already adjusting their business model. I think that what the future holds is that those commercial journals will provide a lot of research tools. They'll essentially make access to the information easier, and they'll charge for that. And the university can take that or leave that, and we already do take that or leave that. EBSCO, JSTOR, BioOne, those are all conglomerates of journals. But my guess is that the industry will respond to this by saying, okay, open access. So I don't think we have to win the whole battle. It's just we have to show them that this is something that the community cares about. And these agreements, like the one here at KU, do that.
You had a question in the back. Do you still have a question?
I'm just curious. Let's say it was a young assistant professor, and I know for the sciences you're expected to publish high-impact research papers. If I were to choose what journal I want to put this in, a high-impact established journal versus a new open-source access sort of journal, I mean, I'm going to choose the big-impact journal because I know my colleagues will respect that. I have no idea what this could have in store for me for tenure and what have you. Could you provide any commentary on, I mean, is there going to be a change or... worry about this?
You got to the right answer, which is to say, if you can publish your dissertation chapter in Science or Nature, do it. Now, the only two caveats to that are, one, after Science or Nature has accepted your dissertation chapter, try to retain some rights. And so you'll not only be in the big name journal, but you'll also have more people around the world able to go and see your work. Second caveat is, and this is a longer-term thing, you now have some open-access journals. Make the difference between open-access journals and the open-access policy that we've been talking about. You now have some open-access journals that are gaining quite a bit of respect. The BMC series, the PLOS series, they're not Science and Nature by any means, but they are... gaining quite a bit of respect, and as an assistant professor, at least in my field, you'd be real happy to publish in PLOS Biology or BMC Evolutionary Biology, something like that.
Mark, did you want to add to
it? Well, I was just going to say that one of the things that that you want with open access is greater impact, and I was going to show you some usage statistics. But let me just explain what it's about. I run an open access journal that's on a European model, where the Academy of Science is in a partner institution. It's in the Republic of Slovenia, pays for some of the upfront costs for production. And they were very happy to have a completely open access journal. So we do both print and open access simultaneously. And the reason they were so excited about it is when they saw that the usage statistics show that we were getting hundreds of hits all over the world, where we expected a very parochial readership of a few dozen people in very narrow places like Central Europe, where they'd be interested in Slavic linguistics, for example, but we're getting every single continent in the world downloading the paper, citations all over the place, places that, it's actually up here. And if you could just, there are the usage statistics. You can see.
And there's screens behind you, too, if you can see.
I'll make it a
just a random paper that I wrote, what I think is a very obscure paper on the change of the sound je to re in early South Slavic, and I would have expected maybe a dozen people to read this in the paper days. But look, there are hundreds and hundreds of hits all over the place. And it's interesting that this is not just random noise, but the top hits are from the places where in those languages they have parallel kinds of developments in the history of their language. So obviously there's people looking for this topic. They're Googling it. They're finding rhoticism. They're getting to my journal they otherwise would not look at. They wouldn't go to the library and look for the journal called Slovene Linguistic Studies because they wouldn't expect to find anything there relevant if they're doing Turkic linguistics or whatever. But they found it because they found a keyword that matched up, and they were able to get to my paper very quickly. So I'm getting exponentially more readership than I would have otherwise. So impact is a big motivating factor, and I think this is exactly what you want as a young assistant professor, pre-tenured, to show that you've got worldwide readership. And this stuff is what the digital repository keeps for you. This data is there permanently. So you put that together in your tenure file and show, look how many people are downloading my article.
So you create like a personal profile then?
You could. What I do, and I have my faculty do, is I have them link on the electronic version of their CV all of the articles that they have in the digital repository, so they link directly to their paper. So they get a hit every time somebody looks them up, finds their CV, finds that they're working on whatever problem they're working on, and they just click through the articles. And somebody's whole corpus potentially could be easily downloadable in a few minutes, whereas, say, you're tracking, Albert Einstein's corpus, and it was scattered all over the place. It would take you quite a while to assemble all of it.
And all of the works in KU ScholarWorks archive are accessible through Google. So our real expectation is that people are searching on Google for a topic and find these papers from any repository, open repository, from scholars around the world, and get access to the paper. It's also important to note that more and more of these journals, particularly the very large ones, are allowing the accepted manuscript version of the paper to be shared without any additional negotiation. So you all know, you submit a paper to a journal, you send it in. We would call that the preprint, or the submitted paper, right? It goes through all the peer review process, and they say, yay, we've accepted your paper. We would call that the accepted manuscript version. So really, it's the typesetting that's not yet done. They might do some copy editing. They might add the graphics to the right places. That version, and then the final one, is the one that shows up in the actual paper or online version. We call that the publisher's PDF, or the publisher's version. More and more publishers are allowing that middle one to be shared. And I think that's fine for most disciplines, because the intellectual content is identical to that which is being shared in the published version. Obviously, if you can afford, or you have a subscription to, or your institution has access to that published one, great. But if not, or you first discover on Google that author final draft, the accepted manuscript, great. So more and more publishers are allowing that, and if you look carefully at your the publication agreement that you're signing with them, you may find evidence of that. But that's another thing. Faculty send me their agreements and say, this is all legalese. What does it actually mean? What can I do with this copy? So this is part of the trend. You know, if we're looking at a long term, 5, 10 years, 20 years out, what is it going to be like? We don't know. But it's definitely moving toward, we have this technology that would make it so easy. Why aren't we sharing it? Why can't I share it openly? Other questions? You had a question a while back.
Yeah. I was thinking it's really an interesting idea to have University of Kansas and Harvard and Stanford and these cool institutions doing open access. But sort of in the spirit of the internet, in the spirit of DARPA, interlinking those ideas so that you could search essentially a giant database of articles, free open access articles. Is there any movement towards like a Wikipedia or a Facebook of?
Well, there is. Have you all heard of Google Scholar? Sometimes you encounter it by accident because if you're looking for scholarly papers, Google will point you to Google Scholar. Right now, that's probably the best thing in terms of cross-discipline, cross-international. It really indexes purely how it defines scholarly.
But also a social network thing like that is academia.edu, where you have personal profiles, and then individual scholars have the option of linking, actually uploading papers similar to a digital repository, but not exactly like it. So that would be something like a cross between Facebook and Google Scholar.
Mm-hmm. One of the major tendencies in the informatics world is away from centralizing data resources. The internet is so pervasive that most of what's happening in terms of sharing information is distributed. And so Google Scholar is not a central depository like a wiki would be, where everything's getting loaded on some server somewhere. Google Scholar is just a portal out to KU, Missouri, North Dakota, et cetera, et cetera. And there are different arguments about what's the most scalable informatics solution, but that's certainly been the trend in a whole bunch of fields over recent years. So I think what you're talking about already exists, but it's just scattered here and there and unified by portals.
Okay. So, in the back, did you have a question?
So as these publishers kind of make the transition in open access with the government mandate that may or may not get passed, will the libraries still, like, they're still going to want to make money? I would assume, I've done a little bit of looking into this, that they might be charging for archive material. So newer material would be open access, but all of the stuff before would not fall under that mandate. Would the libraries still be subscribing to that as well?
That's a good question, and actually I would answer, first of all, it depends on the discipline, because in some disciplines it's reverse. They will share the back issues, but they want those recent ones protected, or vice versa. And you're referring, just for the group's sake, I think you're referring to the FERPA bill that's in Congress right now. The National Institutes of Health already require grant recipients of NIH money to put a copy of the author final draft, that accepted manuscript, in an open repository. There's a bill in Congress right now that would also require other large funded agencies, I think over $100 million. So NSF, NEH would also require of their grant recipients to do a similar thing. So this is very common. The question about how publishers are going to respond. Already, publishers are realizing, like in the sciences, if at KU, the libraries, there are some journals that we pay $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 per year just for that 6-month window, because everything else is open. But they know the top scholars in a field who are at an institution that can afford it will pay for just 6 months of access. Even though if they waited 6 months, it would be free. So we still have subscriptions to those right now. We're urgent. But again, that $4 million a year, another factoid that we didn't share is that the journals, publishers are smart. Every year, on average, the journals raise their prices 5, 10, 15%, averaging out at about 10% per year. If our budgets lay flat, we've lost access every year. So this is another way that the screws are getting tightened on that method. Now, I don't know, Tom, do you have some?
Kind of getting to the question, which is, if everything's open access, why stay subscribed, right? That's what it boils down to. There are several reasons why you stay subscribed. Access to that final version, which in some fields, there are two taxonomists in the back, and they're thinking the International Code of Zoological Nomenclature, right? There are a bunch of reasons why that final version, pagination, things like that, is important. So, now think about what the real cost of publishing is. Ada just said that the charged cost is going up 10% a year. But how many of these journals that you all use are going more and more electronic, and many exclusively electronic? Well, guess what? The major cost in publishing is that paper. And so the real cost of this enterprise is crashing because they're printing many, many fewer hard copies. So what I can imagine is a negotiation between not just KU libraries, but the academic community and the scholarly, the commercial scholarly journals, where you say, okay, look, we stay subscribed if you charge us an honest wage plus an honest profit rather than this hyper-increasing profit that you guys are milking us for right now. And so that's, I think, what will happen. And you see the library community nationally starting to have those discussions about what, how would you do that negotiation?
And, you know, just to, as another little fact, as another little factor, there's, are you in chemistry? Is
that, yes.
I'm seeing right. So the libraries pays, I used to be the librarian for chemistry.
I thought I recognized you.
Yes. that was part of my full-time job, actually. And I can just give a hint that the libraries, the resources in chemistry are extremely expensive. And so we probably at KU give to chemical information to the campus, we probably spend about $150,000, $170,000 a year to buy resources, including SciFinder Scholar, which is a database. Some of you might use PubMed or JSTOR or a variety of kinds, but American Chemical Society is extraordinarily wealthy on the dollars in part that universities are paying to them for that access. The model will probably shift as, again, what other added value can they put to it? And ACS is actually, they've built a robust electronic system, but it's extraordinarily expensive. So they still are making their money in some way. But you all will be around in 10 or 20 years, hopefully. Some of you as scholars, some as researchers and scientists out in the world. So you will get to see how this plays out. And yes, sir.
Yeah, most of the things we've been talking about here is published work. And I was just wondering, because the quality of research depends, for some of us in economics and other related fields, depends highly also on the data you get. And having struggled a bit to get some quality data, I know what it means to how difficult it is. So to what extent will this open access affect or mitigate the problem of accessing quality data, if it will?
Well, actually, a brother, or how do I say this, another part of the open access movement broadly, you might actually call it, there's an access to open knowledge movement, and part of that is open data. So there's a real working hand in hand with open access to scholarship is how do we provide access to the data that comes out of the research. How do we store it, preserve it, you know, and make it accessible to other people? Not just openly, but also accessible in future, you know, files, types, evolve and change, etc. Did you want to speak to this too? But yes, that is it is an important piece of it, and there's more and more talk about open data.
Just to give one example, in the community where I work and the two guys right behind you, biodiversity, we have essentially a system of libraries, but they're libraries of dead animals and plants. And each one of those animals and plants has data associated with it. In the beginning of my career, the access to those data was either closed or was done by letter to individual institutions, and it could take you 2 or 3 years to put together a useful data set. Now, just through one internet portal, you have access to more than 220 million biodiversity records. So we're up to about 1% of the total that exists, but it's about 10% of the total that's digital. And so it's changed massively just in the past 10 years.
And then if you think about the analogous situation in humanities, it used to be that if you wanted to look, say, at a medieval manuscript where there's one copy that exists in the world, you'd have to arrange for a grant to travel to wherever that archive is that holds it. You have hotel rooms and expenses and travel expenses and so forth to go visit that manuscript. And now these things are being digitized in very high quality resolutions with online tools to use, and it essentially zeroes out all of those costs. So it actually will bring down the costs of doing lots of kinds of research, not just in the sciences and economics, but virtually everything.
And I realize it's probably just about 1 o'clock, and you all should have gotten a button. And on the some of the buttons have a star on the back. And if it has a star, you can have a Got Rights t-shirt if you want.
Ada. Star. Ada.
Yes?
I'd like to say one thing.
Let's hear it for you blue t-shirts.
Yay! And Tom wants to say one more thing.
Before you all disappear, I'll just throw out one comment, which is that no university in the country has a student open access policy. We have a student senate. If you're smart, you've worried about your studies and stayed in your department. We have a student senate, and over the past couple years, we've had a couple discussions with the student senate, and there's quite a bit of interest. I think what they need is leadership. So if you guys want to really take a bold step, think about a open access policy for, it would have to be both graduate and undergraduate students, but you all are a big community of publishing scholars.
Or a resolution supporting open access. That's an easier step probably to make. But it is, again, a kind of coalition of willing students who are interested in this that would really have to come together. And if, obviously, you have questions, you're interested in more information, find me, find Town. My office's email is on that. I have business cards here as well, but our office's email is on that program. Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. We're so thrilled that you all came out. I hope the pizza was good. There's still cookies and soda. You can take it with you if you want. We'll sit around here for a bit, and if those of you who have stars on your buttons, you can come get a t-shirt. And thank you very much.
Thank you.